Welcome. I'm Helena Kennedy and I'm the principal here at Mansfield College. And it's my great pleasure to welcome all of you tonight, and especially because this is a very important occasion for us, because we are welcoming tonight into our midst someone we admire greatly. And I'm going to call on our senior fellow, Ross Ballister, to present the citation in a moment. But I wanted just to explain a little bit of background about Carol Sanger, because we got to know this great professor from the United States. She's the professor of law at Columbia Law School. And we got to know her because she came here to Oxford as a visiting professor back in 2010. In fact, before I came here, from 2010 to 2013. But we captured her early on because it was our International Women's Day. And I, of course, knew Carol's work, had read it often. She was one of those great figures in feminist legal circles. And so it was thrilling that I was getting a chance to meet her. And she came along and she did a talk to our students on International Women's Day, and it was wonderful. And the wonderful thing was that then there began a sort of special relationship with Mansfield College in the period afterwards, because she was a connected, coming back to be a visiting research fellow at Rothermere. And we captured her that year too to be a senior research fellow here at Mansfield College. And so during that time, we really got to know and to see the depth of her work and to see how very much she felt as though she belonged to Mansfield. We felt that she was one of us. And for that reason, our governing body, our fellowship, asked that she might become one of us indeed. So if I might call on you, Ros, in order to make the citation.
So I'm delighted and I'm honoured to deliver the citation for Professor Carol Sanger, Barbara Arenstein Black Professor of Law, Columbia Law School, on the occasion of her formal receipt of her honorary fellowship from Mansfield College. Her nomination as an honorary fellow rests on her high academic distinction in a field of research of specific interest to the college. Professor Sanger is a world-renowned scholar in the common law, and her textbook on contract law, Cases and Materials on Contracts, is the most used in United States law schools and widely in the UK. She's also a significant voice in human rights law, and there's a special synergy for us with the Human Rights Institute of Oxford Law Faculty, which is hosted here at Mansfield. And as you entered, you will have seen those lovely buildings that are going up in the corner there, that gorgeous golden stone that welcomes the Institute on our site. She's a major voice in family law and in debates about gender and rights, publishing in 2007 Family Law Stories, an anthology of commissioned essays on 12 significant family law cases. And in 2005, with Deborah Rode, she edited a book called Gender and Rights. As the principal said, we're also honouring Carol Sanger today as a friend to the college. I first met Carol in March 2012, when I was tutor for women at this college, and she came to speak at an event for International Women's Day at the college. And to a rapt audience, she quietly and intelligently and thoroughly talked through the profound inequality between men and women that still shapes all our political, social, economic, and intellectual experience across the globe. She brings a kind of wisdom into the room with her when she speaks. And if you look up wisdom in the Oxford English Dictionary, you'll find that wisdom is more than abstruse learning or intellectual knowledge. It's a kind of teaching, and especially an ethical teaching, a way of training others to think the best thoughts with the best and most rigorous testing of the rightness of those thoughts. And wisdom is often personified as a woman. One of my favourite poets, Thomas Gray, in his Hymn to Adversity, describes wisdom as one of the forces that resists adversity. And he describes her this way: wisdom in sable garb arrayed, immersed in rapturous thought profound. Those of us who know Carol Sanger will both recognise her in this and not recognise her. She does indeed make thought a kind of profound rapture. She writes with a lucid and thoughtful prose that makes a literary critic like myself weep with envy. And that's not a style that's often associated with legal argument. But she's also not prone to array in sable garb. There's a cool style about Carol on paper and in person. Her learning, if it is a kind of garb, is, like her sartorial choices, worn lightly with humour and panache. In the academic year 2015-16, we also had the honour of hosting Professor Sanger, a senior research visiting fellow at Mansfield. Over that period, she was composing the book material from which she will present today, about abortion terminating pregnancy in 21st century America, from Harvard University Press. And I went to several seminars and workshops which brought together scholars from Oxford from a huge variety of disciplines to listen to and respond to her ideas, from law, from literature, from medicine, from politics, from sociology. And there was a kind of electricity in these occasions where we all felt invited by Carol to bring our expertise to bear on a matter of urgency as well as difficulty. Now, these meetings were before the election of Donald Trump, but those of us who heard Carol speak then were probably, like her, not surprised to see what a hot-button issue he would make it in his campaign, nor to see that the first day in the Oval Office saw him sign an executive order banning federal money going to international groups that perform or provide information on abortions. Now, more than any other time in history, America needs the wisdom of scholars such as Professor Sanger to hold a line against the cruel and inattentive pursuit of naked interest and ignorant prejudice. Unlike President Trump, Carol has a gift not only of talking, but of listening, a gift much underrated. You can hear in every page of this book her attentive listening, especially to the voices and experience of those who feel themselves to be outside of the law, beneath the law, unable to speak and be heard with regard to the law. Carol shows in this book that to talk about abortion is to talk about more than a legal or medical or private experience. As she puts it, amidst the fog of abortion wars, something has gotten lost. This is the possibility of conversation at a lower decibel by women concerning their own abortion decisions and experiences. We understand why most women don't talk about abortion at the level of individual experience. Yet this form of silence, says Carol, takes a toll on women's well-being. It turns out there's something literal about being weighed down by a secret. And there is something extraordinary about being able to write a book about abortion that leaves a reader like myself feeling lighter, feeling liberated, feeling that the weight of thought and anger might be a lever to see clear blue horizons and futures. Carol's wisdom provides a kind of companionship. Wisdom in Thomas Gray's poem, You'll Be Pleased to Know, Carol, is accompanied by other women. Specifically, Melancholy is a silent maid with leaden eye. Warm Charity, the general friend, justice to herself severe, and pity dropping soft the sadly pleasing tear. And all of these qualities abound in About Abortion. They're the qualities that make academic scholarship, I think, worth doing. So for your wisdom, your intellectual and personal companionship, I thank you, Carol, and for them we honour you today in the small way in which the college can, on behalf of the many whose voices you have given room.
My great honour to present to you the document that assures you that you are an honorary fellow of Mansfield College.
Thank you very much. Well, that made it worth writing the book. And here's a copy of it for the library.
Oh, wonderful.
So I'm extremely happy to be back at Mansfield, and I want to thank the governing body in the deepest sort of way for including me even more warmly in your community by making me an honorary fellow. I'm indeed honored by this and excited to be part of this college, even at an honorary distance. So my topic tonight is Image and Influence, the Fetus in Art. My lecture is taken from a chapter in my new book about abortion. And this chapter is called The Eye of the Storm, and you will see why shortly. Now, 2 years ago, some in this audience heard me present another challenging chapter from the book that was called Fathers and Fetuses, What Would Men Do? And I use the word challenging for tonight's lecture as well. And I don't mean challenging in that you have to speak Latin or know physics to understand what I'm saying. But although what I say will be clear, its meaning is the challenge, and something I hope we will discuss at the lecture's end. Indeed, some of you may have sparks go off next week or a year from now, and because I'm an honorary fellow, you will know how to find me and by email, and please do. Remember, I know where you live, so as ideas come. Because this lecture sits in the larger context of an entire book, I thought it might be useful to give you a sense of the tone and goal of About Abortion by reading just the first three paragraphs, so you'll see what I'm up to here. So this is just from the preface. Any book about abortion necessarily begins in media res. Oh, so much for not having to know Latin. didn't catch that. This is because the problem of unwanted pregnancy does not start with abortion. Abortion follows pregnancy, whether that pregnancy has been much sought after and is highly desired, or whether it is the worst thing ever. Pregnancy, in its turn, follows sexual intercourse, whether that intercourse was calculated, casual, or coerced. Because we live in modern times, pregnancy and so abortion may also follow more technological forms of conception, such as embryo implantation. To say that abortion falls in the middle of things is to say that abortion is located at a discrete intersection in a woman's life. On one side, there is pregnancy. On the other side, there is non-pregnancy and the status quo with regard to the number of children. A mother of two remains a mother of two. A girl does not become a mother. Second paragraph. This is not to say that a woman's life necessarily proceeds exactly as it would had there been no pregnancy and no abortion, though many lives do. For some women, abortion registers as a profound loss, the date or a projected birth date reflected upon, sometimes commemorated for years to come. For many others, the core reaction is one of relief and the welcome return of the preferred, at least for now, non-pregnant self that almost got away. Still, other women experience both relief, the most widely reported emotion following abortion, and some form of regret or wistfulness, not about the decision itself, but because the circumstances around the pregnancy, partner, finances, obligations, plans were just not right enough to proceed. Last paragraph. In this way, every abortion has a context, a set of befores and imagined afters that inform how women's decisions about abortion are made and how they are experienced. It is as though, on the chronological spectrum of a woman's life, a notional pushpin has been planted on the spot marking the decision. That same pin marks the subject of this book. How women confront and decide about unwanted pregnancy within the complicated structures of constraint, personal, cultural, and legal, that frame the issue of abortion in modern America. And so this chapter is, I'll explain how it fits in, but that gives you a sense of what I'm after. I said there was personal constraint, legal constraint, and cultural, the subject of my lecture, thank you. So personal constraints are just that. It's up to every woman to decide, based on her own commitments, how she will resolve an unwanted pregnancy, or a pregnancy that has become unwanted, something that can happen with a single telephone call from a boyfriend, an employer, or a doctor conveying the results of prenatal testing. The legal constraints on abortion, connected, of course, to political will, grow by the minute. Our vice president has pledged to assign, here's his quote, "I am going to assign Roe to the ash heap of history where it belongs." And our states come up with ever more inventive ways to burden access to the procedure. But it is the aspect of culture that we'll be looking at tonight, because, as I hope will become clear, views about abortion are formed by accretion as one thinks and one listens, and as I mean to show here, as one looks around. And so my remarks fit interestingly with those of Ben Okri, who spoke about putting poetry into politics 2 weeks ago, here, on this spot. I come at the intersection of art and power differently, as I am concerned with how art, in this case paintings and sculptures of fetuses, can participate in cultural projects that we might not regard as necessarily poetic. So he wanted more poetry into politics. I want less politics out of art, but we'll see how that goes. So now, I'm not suggesting art is always made for political purposes, but that it can be deployed for such purposes. Indeed, although there is nothing inevitable about the power the fetal image currently embodies, at least in the US, I want to show how fetal imagery has almost always been political, or at least ideological in its form and purpose. And I'll conclude that the current deployment of the image for political ends is really nothing new and may even be somewhat unstable. I've divided this into four parts. I don't know why. I mean, it'll just so you'll know we're moving forward. And you'll see that. Yes, okay. So part one is called The Eye of the Storm, or Introduction. On August 29th, 2005, as Hurricane Katrina approached the Gulf Coast of the United States, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, a federal agency, captured the storm's progress in brightly colored satellite pictures. The threatening hurricane appears as sort of a dense, swirling mass with a small eye at its center, and the tail sort of thinning out into what might look like a large paisley or perhaps a tadpole. But others saw a different design. On August 30th, a group called Columbia Christians for Life sent out a press release with a NOAA picture of Katrina bearing down on the Gulf Coast. Ay, ay, ay. Good. Excuse the New Yorkism. Okay. The accompanying text stated that the picture, quote, "looks like a six-week unborn human child as it comes ashore. The image looks like an unborn human baby facing west in the womb." I guess the baby had a compass. In the early weeks of gestation, approximately 6 weeks, even the orange color of the image is reminiscent of a commonly used pro-life picture of early prenatal development. Now, according to Columbia Christians for Life, this resemblance was no coincidence. As their email explained in caps, "Louisiana has 10 child murder by abortion centers, 5 are in New Orleans," and it concluded with the imperative, "God's message, repent, America." Now, what surprised me most about this press release was not that a pro-life group would hold legal abortion responsible for all the misery in the world, but that once I was alerted, I had no trouble seeing the fetus either. And this struck me as interesting. That we've all, in the US in any case, become used to this image. And the ease with which we all see fetal likenesses, even in the unlikely setting of a stratum above the earth, is the first strand in a knot I hope to untangle. The meaning we give to what we see is one question, but I want to suggest that the mere identification of an object through familiarity with its image is not only a precursor to establishing intimacy with it, but a form of meaning itself. Now, the interesting thing about Katrina is it brings something, this imagery brings something new to the table of fetal imagery, because ferocity is not often attached to the fetal image. The notion of a vengeful fetus operating at hurricane strength is arresting. The standard story is that fetuses are at risk of having harm done to them, not the other way around. Yes. So this is the image we've come to love. Gentle, thumb-sucking presences who parents are sometimes told wave or smile to those of us who peer in through ultrasound. In fact, I'm feeling kind of warm and cuddly just as I read this out. Now, assumptions about this response to fetal imagery, some sort of maternal tie evoked, is why pro-life legislatures around the U.S. have enacted such things as mandatory ultrasound statutes that require women to have an ultrasound before they may consent to abortion and also be asked, do you want to look at your unborn child, as part of the informed component of informed consent. The idea is if you see your fetus, you will A, know it's a person, because what else could it be, B, be awed in an almost religious sense, and C, change your mind about aborting. Now, I believe, oh, I have this written here, parenthetical. I believe that women who terminate a pregnancy know exactly what they're doing, that legislators know pregnant women know what they are doing, and that the purpose of the legislation is less to inform than to punish. Close paren. Okay. Now, most women who terminate pregnancies do for well before the end of the first trimester or around, well, before the end of the first trimester or around 8 to 10 weeks, when what you see is more like this. Yet even this little blob or lima bean, because one never likes to think of their own granddaughter as a blob, signifies what it will become. This is the bean in the previous slide 9 months later. You see what happens if you don't abort. You get a darling baby girl. And if you are really lucky, you get a darling lefty baby who goes on marches. That was during the election. Okay, before we leave Hurricane Katrina, I want to return to a different take on the havoc wrought by the storm. In the dramatic opening of a book called Embryo, A Defense of Human Life, two natural law scholars, well known, describe how little Noah Benson Markham was nearly drowned in Katrina's floodwaters. Trapped in a flooded hospital, we are told how Noah, one of the youngest residents of New Orleans to be saved from Katrina, was saved due to the heroic efforts of 10 emergency responders who maneuvered flat-bottom boats to reach him just in the nick of time. It turns out that at the time of his rescue, Noah was an embryo floating with 1,400 other frozen embryos in a canister of liquid nitrogen. The authors conclude that, quote, if those officers had never made it to Noah's hospital, there can be little doubt that the toll of Katrina would have been 1,400 human beings higher than it already was. Now, I myself had great doubts about calculating Katrina's death toll this way. I think frozen embryos and not little children would have been lost had the canister gone under, which is not to say that the frozen embryos have no intrinsic value or are not owed respect. But what's interesting is that Noah's rescue tells a political story as well. Emergency responders were in short supply during Katrina. Noah Benton Markham was saved, and elderly patients at hospitals all around New Orleans were not. Okay, part two, a quick visual genealogy. Cambridge historian Nick Hopwood, who studies wax models of embryos used in 19th century research, medical research, has noted that in order to understand these models or question today the power of embryo images, we need to recover past meanings too. And what I want to do in this quick section is trace fetal meanings by looking at fetuses, a run-through of what fetuses were understood to look like. My purpose is twofold. First, I want to show that the fetus has often been used for political ends, and that these ends have differed over time, which in turn might dislodge present claims that there is only one meaning of prenatal life, and that is that it is equal in moral value to a person, or as the Times would have it, a born person. Second, I want to alert us to some recent dislodgings and disruptions. So we begin with a 14th century Belgian tapestry or altar cloth entitled The Visitation. Can you see? If you can't see, buy the book. Okay. Now, You may see the fetuses there. This is beautiful. This is just a tiny little piece of the larger altar cloth. Readers may be familiar with John the Baptist, who, when in his mother Elizabeth's womb, leapt for joy in recognition of Jesus' unborn presence as Elizabeth greeted Mary after the Annunciation. And that's what we see here. And I'll say more about this in a moment. But there are also famous Jewish fetuses who, in the rabbinic narratives from the 10th century CE, studied the Torah in utero, fasted on Yom Kippur, and sang after crossing the Red Sea. The Buddha, too, has a long and detailed fetal life, living in a fabulously sealed palace inside his mother and exiting through her side so as not to have to deal with her blood and other fluids. So these are some of the stories that were told. But why? What work did a jumping fetus or a praying fetus do? It turns out that in each of these accounts, the fetal activity was connected to thickening norms and struggles in the non-fetal realm. The leaping child of the Bible became important when a rivalry later arose between the separate followers of John and Jesus regarding which of them was supposed to be the Messiah. Followers of John argued that he was the older and more able of the two. Note the jumping. And Jesus sort of just sat there like a lump. Luke 1 has been, and this began in the womb. Luke 1 has been interpreted as settling the matter by acknowledging that although the older John preceded Jesus in time, his talents were for the purpose of preparing for Jesus, not of preempting him. So John leaps not because he was more clever, but in recognition of Jesus' superior presence. I'll skip the part about the Jewish fetuses, but the point was that the rabbis were trying to build a story that Jewishness began in the womb, and of this locating Jewishness in the womb, knowledgeable fetuses conforming to particular rabbinical practices of worship was a piece of a particular political project. Now, the adaptability of fetuses to such varied purposes is both impressive and highly relevant to our own time. For the modern fetus, its body, its image, its potential serves as an opaque, if not quite a blank slate on which current preoccupations can be inscribed. Okay, we move now to the 16th century. So at this time, miscarried embryos and fetuses were known. It was known if a woman had a miscarriage. And so what they looked like was visible. You could see something. Especially if you pull back the membranes. But the fetus in utero was presented quite differently than what was seen in during miscarriages or stillbirths. These early medical illustrations depicted fetuses as well-developed cherubic little men, always men, energetically engaged in what I think of as an encapsulated fitness regime, stretching, running, with freestanding balloon-shaped containers that depicted the uterus. These were all on a page, just like that. So as you see, women's bodies had left the building centuries before ultrasound similarly obscured fetal connection to the woman. The early homunculi pictured in these woodcuts and drawings reflected the scientific theory of preformation that posited the fetus as being fully formed from the start. All it needed was time to grow. Now this was demonstrably untrue, but that was the depiction. And this book that these came from was German, then it was published here. It was sold very heartily for 300 years because people were thrilled to look inside the womb. It was a very exciting thing. Over time, additional details, the umbilical cord, placental tissue, were added. Nonetheless, the basic schema of a self-sufficient, freestanding fetus was in place for centuries. By the 1700s, a more baby-like fetus had come into medical drawings and in the life-size three-dimensional wax models now used in obstetric training. I don't think the fetus is in there, unless it's way down there. I haven't brought a baby with me here. Many of the 18th century wax fetuses looked like baby Jesus in the creche, filled out, curly hair, cherubic. In contrast, the women into which the models fit were not at all Mary-like, but instead were more like reclining odalisques, sometimes wearing pearls, their hair unbound, fanning out among the... Am I saying another one? Oh, no. Fanning out around the face in almost sensual abandon. And I just have a note here, there's more to be made of this, but not now. Okay, so I'm now going to leap into the 20th century, when the first full view, first public view of the fetus in utero, we'll come back to that point too, took place. In 1965, Life magazine published Swedish photographer Lennart Nilsson, he just died about 3 months ago, beguiling color photos of the fetus, more or less in utero. Are these familiar? Is this familiar to you? It made
yes.
It made such a moment when it happened. It was miraculous. And the only thing was, it was a bit of a hedge on the bet that it was these were actual fetuses in utero, because with one exception, these were in fact fetal corpses. Hedging on the promise of the accompanying text that these were human embryos in their natural state. All but one had been surgically removed and were the result of miscarriage and legal abortion in Nilsson's home country, Sweden. The fetal bodies were then cleaned up, no blood, isolated from their natural environment, no sign of a woman or her body, and then backlit and suspended. That's the magical space business you see with the stars in the background, suspended in a special fluid to achieve a luminous floating quality. Okay, sorry, one sec. Well, we can just keep that up for a moment while I tell you about photography. But we now, after the last slide was a photograph, and this changed everything. It changed everything political when you could actually see a fetus prior to its birth. And as literary critic Lauren Berlant observed, when the fetus became available to photography, it came to occupy a new scale of existence, often taking up an entire frame, like a portrait. And some of you may have, or have children who have, or friends, people who have photographs of theirs. It's usually the first picture in a baby's album now, the prenatal picture. Within a few years, the routinization of ultrasound had made the image slightly less miraculous, except, of course, to the parents, but far more accessible. Almost everyone has seen and probably admired, although there is some, you're never quite sure what embryo etiquette is and what you're supposed to say when you see this, as happily, excuse me, sorry, expectant parents share a baby's first picture with the rest of us. Sonograms are also now used to create bespoke fetal sculptures for use, as the advertising indicates, at gender and reveal parties. Do you have that here?
No.
It's too horrible to imagine.
Not yet.
What? Not yet. Right. Well, yes. I'm going to skip the importance of different fetal body parts at different times, but maybe we'll come back to that. It's so interesting. Well, I'll just tell you. The significance of what body parts are important and what people are interested in changes over time. So an anthropologist named Lynn Morgan has explained that the visible tail of a human embryo, we're going to see one in a minute, and this tail lasts only 2 weeks, came as a great shock when revealed to the American public in the early 20th century. There was some concern that some babies might be born with tails. And this was just around the time of the Scopes monkey trial. And so it got everyone extremely anxious. And as Morgan states, the significance was not in the tail per se, nor even in the embryo qua embryo, but in how people coaxed those little bits of flesh to mirror their social worlds. Morgan observes that embryo tails were a focal point for debates over civilization, science, barbarism, secularism, atheism, and faith. And over time, feet became very important. And so you may have seen people in the US who do wear little lapel feet pins. And feet are important because they're identifiable at 10 weeks, which is very early. And then they're life-size feet that you can see. And to compare feet to a head, we don't really want to look at a fetal head at 10 weeks. or to the whole embryo, as one person said, it's described as a wretched-looking creature with its ungainly face and head, off balance and poorly formed. Lately, in the U.S., people have been attending to the fetal heart because you can hear it around 6 weeks, and so this is being used. A number of states are passing legislation that says you can't have an abortion after the fetal heartbeat, which is clearly unconstitutional. Okay. And I hope the Supreme Court consults me when it gets there. Part three, the fetus in art. Fetuses have not often been the subject of painting. A few fetuses turn up in Edward Munch's work. There. See? Now we go back to Aubrey Beardsley. There. Okay. I love this picture. We have a woman and a grumpy looking fetus who's reading a book called Incipit Vita Nova, New Life Begins. There's also a very interesting drawing by Frida Kahlo, in which a naked Frida Kahlo sheds giant tears and there's a small dead fetus at her feet. And more recently, British artist Tracy Emin has depicted a possible miscarriage or abortion under the title of Terribly Wrong. But as a general matter, there have been few painterly instances of embryos or fetuses. This is much less the case with sculptural representations, where the characteristics of the medium, plasticity, three-dimensionality, and durability, offer the possibility of meanings and uses not available with two-dimensional representations. Sculptures are more accessible on account of the possibility of being in public space. Huge sculptures may induce awe by their scale alone, as they are meant to do, and smaller pieces offer the opportunity for more tactile, intimate connection. And I want to start with the monumental. Oh, this is not supposed to be here, but this is a woman whose fetus is testifying before an Ohio state legislature. The fetus got subpoenaed. It's testifying, not her, and she's being wanded. And what is the fetus testifying? That it's alive, that it has a heartbeat. And this is what goes on in my country. Okay. 14 gigantic sculptures were dramatically unveiled to the amplified sound of a beating heart outside the new Sidra Medical and Research Center in Doha, Qatar. How I'm told to pronounce it. Yeah. Okay. The installation chronicles the process of gestation from conception to birth and was created by, quote, controversial British bad boy sculptor Damien Hirst. It starts with a 16-foot early embryo posed on upright on a spiny tail with a squat amphibian head and ends 12 sculptures later with a 46-foot freestanding scowling newborn, left leg raised Godzilla style, as though ready to stomp out small villages. The work was commissioned by Sheikha al-Masayyed Hamad bin Khalafi al-Thani, chairwoman of the Qatar Museums Authority, who called it an audacious work of art. One critic described it as 216 tons worth of bronze babies. The sculptures are available, widely seen from both the motorway and the desert. And the subject matter, massive spliced wounds revealing developmentally graduated fetus, is a bold move in an Islamic country where unclothed bodies, let alone reproductive body parts, are not common public fare. Hirst's own goals for the project were to, quote, instill in the viewer a sense of awe and wonder at the extraordinary human process, and to expand a cross-cultural dialogue between the UK and Qatar. A spokesman for the British Society for the Protection of Unborn Children praised Qatar's authorities for their eye-catching public initiative, which was the means of saving unborn children. The array of giant fetuses thus serves a medley of purposes: artistic provocation, educational display, pro-life celebration, awe-inducing spectacle, cultural gesture towards modernity, and bilateral goodwill. But it turns out that his giant, enormous sculptures are not the first monumental representations of fetuses. Art historian Carolyn Tate has studied a fetal puzzle from ancient Mesoamerica. Giant stone figures, the earliest accurate image of the fetus yet recognized in any artistic tradition, that were carved by the Olmec peoples of southern Mexico between 900 and 400 BCE. The massive statues stand 6 feet tall, and they represent humans at human embryos at about 6 to 8 weeks gestation. They were discovered in 1925. There was a big dispute. For a long time, everyone thought they were dwarfs. But Carolyn Tate and another colleague assembled a panel of neonatologists, and they studied them, and they found that they mirrored almost exactly, that they could tell what stage of development each one was at by how it was shaped. Each was modeled on a particular embryo and depicted so naturalistically, wide-set lidless eyes, flattened noses, and accurate head-body ratio of 1:3, that an investigative panel of neonatologists was able to pinpoint which week of gestation each was in. In general, they stand ex utero on deeply flexed legs with arms crossed over the chest, the very positions that fetal limbs often take in utero. Interestingly, they were commonly adorned with the iconography of maize. You can see a little bit that there's stalks of corn on the helmets that they're wearing. And those helmets are a whole other story. There's something called the Mesopotamian baseball game. It's so interesting, but we'll stick with the maize. So connecting the maize iconography with the physical placement of the statues at the ancient site at La Venta, Tate concluded that the statues were something like seminal human maize beings, which were part of a processional visual narrative of the Mesoamerican creation story. She says, in this sophisticated conceptualization of creation and regeneration, the Olmec identified similarities between embryos in the womb and planted seeds. And it was into this larger creation story that the fetuses fit, not as deities, but as seed spirits, the original seeds of the human race. Now, similar representations of 12 to 10 week early fetuses are available today in much smaller scale, made not out of stone, but out of resin and plastic. These ones come from Heritage House, a pro-life merchandise retailer who sells the precious one. It comes in 3 colors, this is my favorite part, black, white, and Spanish. plain or wrapped in little blankets, and they are sold at discount in bulk. But for their tiny size, 2.5 inches, and the blankets, precious ones bear a remarkable resemblance to the Olmec statues at La Venta. And the reason that I have them by the back of someone's briefcase is so they look like they're out of focus, but they're not. That's how they're made, because they're meant to look as they are. And I just wanted to clarify that. Okay, this is another one. This is called Tiny One. Precious tiny ones. They all have one tiny life. It's a little more sophisticated, and it's a little more expensive. And its legs come either up like that or down. If you want the gender revealed or not, you can check that off along with Spanish or whatever color you want. And here, ideology marches straight into play. The Heritage House sales copy states that the doll, that would be this doll, that the doll's beautiful detail, softness, and weight can really move hearts and minds. They are recommended as gifts and for use outside abortion clinics, schools, and in crisis pregnancy center. A crisis pregnancy center in the U.S. is a place where you might go to think they're going to help you decide what to do about your unwanted pregnancy, but they're run by evangelical Christian groups, and they urge you to keep your child and put it up for adoption. So that's just what the phrase crisis pregnancy center means. In 2014, the dolls created quite a ruckus among fairgoers at the North Dakota State Fair, as seen in the headlines from pro-life and pro-choice blogs. 1, abortion advocates go nuts over pro-lifers distributing fetal models. The other, worst state fair ever has squishy fetus toys for unsuspecting children. Now, here we come to one tiny life. Oh, this is what tiny lives waiting to be painted. And the creator of One Tiny Life explains that her purpose is, my deepest desire is that a mom who was considering the abortion option would hold one of these tiny babies and change her mind. So we see, Now, sculpture theory explains how holding the doll might work toward that end. In his study of small Neolithic figurines, art historian Doug Bailey states that although we don't really know what these Neolithic figurines were, toys or votives or fertility fetishes or mini deities, thinking about them, not trying to figure out what they were, but how they functioned, may inform our understanding. And as handheld, they were handheld. Many of them had rounded bottoms, and so they couldn't stand up on their own. And Bailey observes the general psychological principle that people gain subtle empowerment from miniaturized works. Holding a miniature anthropomorphic form like the Neolithic figures might give one an increased sense of power, and when the figure looks like a tiny baby, holding it may also trigger a desire to protect. Okay, now precious ones have been put to other uses as well, and Roz pointed out that I am a lawyer. So here it comes. In 2010, as part of a campaign to, quote, put God back in the schools, a group of religious high school students in Roswell, New Mexico, do you know anything about Roswell? Okay. It's where the UFOs go. Okay, but these are the high school students. They had a group called the Relentless, organized a distribution of 2,500 precious ones at the two high schools. As other students entered the school, each was given one of the 2-inch dolls with a card explaining that it was the actual size and weight of a 12-week-old baby. The tag also quoted a passage from Psalms, "For you formed my inward parts, you knew me in my mother's womb," and provided contact information for the Chavez County Pregnancy Resource Center, another pro-life counseling center that provides that only provides for adoption. Now, the doll distribution became a federal matter after school administrators had to, quote, shut the whole thing down, unquote, following doll-related disruptions at both high schools. Students had torn the dolls' heads off and used them as projectiles and pencil erasers. Dolls were used to plug up toilets, and some were doused with hand sanitizer and set alight. Charmingly, one or more male students, this is a quote from the case, removed the dolls' heads, inverted the bodies to make them resemble penises, and hung them on the outside of their pant zippers. The Relentless argued in court that the shutdown violated their right to free speech, freedom of religion, and equal protection because other students had been allowed to hand out Valentines. That is to say, they said, distributing the dolls was both a constitutional right and their Christian duty. The Federal Appeals Court ruled in favor of the school district on the grounds that the students had failed to get approval for their distribution ahead of time, kind of a technical excuse, but it got them out of the case. But it's less the constitutional posture of the case that interests us than how the little dolls were used and what this all meant. To some, the dolls signified nothing more than another destructible piece of plastic. Yet destroying them triggered more political meanings. The Fifth Circuit noted that students engaged in name-calling and insults over the topic of abortion. And the conversion of fetuses to penises was distinctly transgressive, an almost campy form of defiance. So something is going on here. Now, precious one, that's a little handheld precious one, okay. Precious one and tiny life are meant to prevent abortion through a woman's physical connection to a figurine that fits in the palm of the hand. But sculpture is often invoked after an abortion, as we see in the Japanese practice of mizuko koyo, a rite kuyo, for an aborted fetus, mizuko, or water child, sort of an in-between kind of life. This developed in the mid-1970s. About that time, independent religious sects improvised a ritual for women who had terminated a pregnancy and who wanted to offer amends to the spirit of the aborted child. This was done by purchasing a small stone statue. Each temple has its own variety of what they look like, but they're all the same guy, whose name is Jizo, the protector of children and fetal spirits. In Jizo wears he's bald and he wears the robe of a Buddhist monk. But the statues lined up row upon row are often dressed in bright baby clothes and surrounded by toys and colorful pinwheels brought by their relatives, giving the gardens the cheerful look of kind of an over-decorated child center. William LaFleur explains that the statue represents both the soul of the departed spirit to whom the parents offer apologies and Jizo to whom the parents appeal to guide their aborted fetus through the other world of dead souls. So it connects a bit, if any of you are reading George Saunders' Lincoln and the Bardo. It isn't here yet, all right. You'll love it. Okay, so how should this ritualized apology to a stone figure be understood? Certainly it resonates within some Asian cultures, because the fetus children died before their parents. They have, in a sense, become their parents' ancestors. And giving offerings to ancestors is a traditional feature of practice in Taiwan, Korea, Vietnam, as well as Japan. Some have argued that the ritual, this is interesting, the statue, the package of prayer services, the way you can buy someone to do the apologizing for you, pay like a substitute, is at core a commercial enterprise concocted by startup or financially failing religious sects to generate an income stream. And interestingly, these gardens are all located at the intersections of major highways, but that's one argument. And others say that women want to reflect more, and this offers them a public ritual, which they can perform and help their fetal spirit move on to its next stage. What's interesting, though, is that there's nothing against abortion in this. Abortion is well accepted in Japan and this is not a political action. It's entirely private. So we see that the meaning of a stone figure or a plastic model is not fixed across cultures. Indeed, what I wonder is some 2,000 years from now, when our own sculptures are unearthed, whether Hearst's bronze uteruses perched on poles in a Mideastern desert, or boxes of resin mini fetuses scattered around North America, they too, like the Olmec fetuses of Leventa, are likely to present formidable interpretive challenges to anthropologists, art historians, theologians, and political sciences of the future. Okay, I have one last bit. Do we have time? I have like six minutes more.
Good.
Okay, it's hardly anything coming up, but it's good. The last part is called Scary Fetuses, Playful Fetuses. In discussing Mizuko Kuyo, I forgot to mention how it is that women were alerted to the new ritual. And it came about because there was a tie-in with magazines. I'm not saying Teen Vogue, but magazines for teenage girls, which ran a whole bunch of stories in the 70s about teenage girls lying in their beds with gigantic fetuses over them like barrage balloons. And they were taken from ultrasound pictures, but they flipped it so the curvy part was coming down on them, telling them, do this ritual or we will plague you with, and then there was a series of symptoms that sound a lot like menopause. I thought this has been noted. And that they'll never have a love life. So that's what did it, these spirits, and they are called Tatari. Now, we don't have Tatari in the US, but we do have a fair few cinematic spirits. And I'm thinking of Ridley Scott's Alien, or Eraserhead, or The Kindred, or Ghoulies, or Leviathan, or The Invasion of the Body Snatchers, or the remake of The Fly, Sly 2, Pumpkinhead, and there are more. And we need more cultural critics to tell us what these scary fetus-like things are after. However, things change. What was once a disturbing moment of horror has become, in some ways, a playful pregnancy trope. Google images quickly reveal pregnant Halloween revelers wearing t-shirts through which little arms burst through holding their own pumpkin containers ready for trick or treat. This woman is expecting twins, so she has two babies bursting forth from her abdomen. It's, you know, disgusting, but there are tons of them online and other versions. This seems a far cry from the monster bursting out of John Hurt's chest in Alien. It is clear that these women are having fun. They have poured fake blood around the protruding arms. They have posted pictures online. They are sporting with, perhaps owning, their inner alien. So this is a far cry from the demon in Rosemary's Baby. Now it's sort of all in good fun and perform in public. So this lecture has been to alert us to the uses of fetal imagery over time and its vexed meanings in our own time. Yet, I'll say, in comparison to earlier times, there is a greater sense of playfulness among sculptors, authors, cartoonists. There's also, I don't think I brought it. Oh yeah, this is holiday wear for the pregnant. These are earrings. That's a cookie cutter. Oh, and my favorite. Okay, these are done by a French sculptor who molds little fetal superheroes, and then he encases them, these are about this big, in plexiglass. And they're usually not stacked up like that. I think I have one more. Yeah. They're very expensive, or I would get Catwoman. Okay. So some of what we saw, like the Santa hats, is cutesy in nature. And some is more outre, like superhero fetal specimens in bottles. So despite a general agreement among pro-choice advocates that pro-life advocates have held the rhetorical advantage, unborn child, partial birth abortion, the fetus may no longer wholly be owned and operated by those who oppose legal abortion. Certainly some uses are distasteful, like fetal porn, which exists as well. Some is invented, like sci-fi and digital modeling. Others is therapeutic, like Mizuko Kuyo. Some meant as meaningful fun and others just as fun. And sometimes I can't tell the intent. The fetal artifact simply is. The playfulness with which the fetus can be approached, modeled, and transformed disrupts the pro-life grip on what fetal imagery means. Some of the disruption is concerning. You know, fetal doll heads as penises. No. Though we can't know whether the fetal imagery was ever sacred to a bunch of high school cut-ups. Nevertheless, the disruption wouldn't be quite so disruptive if it were not responding to or knowingly set alongside a more glorified, more official notion how a fetus should be treated. An analogy is found in the current phenomenon of hell houses. Have you ever heard of this? Hell houses are sin-themed haunted houses set up by evangelical Christians around Halloween. Abortion is one of the 5 featured sins. And there's a script that you can order them, so you can set your haunted house up, and you take the children or the teenagers through, and it shows you an AIDS room, an abortion room, and how everyone basically goes to hell. And as performance theorist Ann Pellegrini explains, the idea is not to scare the bejesus out of you, but to scare you to Jesus. The problem is that some of the performances of sin and its wages are so powerful that their meaning to the audience cannot be wholly controlled by pastoral intent. Pellegrini describes the poignant death of a gay man, who in the play she went to was played by a straight woman, from AIDS, who was the pastor's wife, in one of the recommended sketches. Might this tableau prompt empathy, she asks, rather than the intended lesson of revulsion or fear that this will happen to you if you choose this path? So too with the novel twists on fetal iconography. Just what is a teen who keeps a costumed superhero on his or her shelf doing? I don't know, but it seems a far cry from Precious Ones.